Ave listeners, a quick announcement before the episode. To celebrate our C episode, we will be recording a live show of Emperors of Rome in Melbourne, Australia, August 2nd, 6 p.m. Tickets are free. I've put links on social media, or you can find them on eventbrite.com.au. That's eventbrite.com.au. Just search for Emperors of Rome. That's August 2nd, 6 p.m, Melbourne, Australia. Hope to see you there. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode XCVII, Sallust. Sallust was a Roman politician and historian writing during the time of the fall of the Roman Republic. The two main surviving examples of his work are the Catiline Conspiracy and the Jugurthine War, and they give an informative and partisan view of important Roman events. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Sallust is a really important writer of the late Republic. He's a historian. He writes two works that we still have and a third one we've mostly lost, and the two we have concentrate on specific events. So it's not that kind of sprawling history that covers decades or hundreds of years. He's talking about moments of crisis in ancient Rome. And he is a writer who comes right at the moment that some would say Julius Caesar is destroying the Republic and just before the civil war that leads to Octavian's rise. So it's kind of a crucial point in Rome's history.
And so he's living right in that period.
He's not only living in it, but he's also involved in it politically for a certain amount of time anyway.
Let's talk about his background then. Who was he and how did he come to be involved in Rome's inner circles of power?
Okay, well, he's from the center of Italy, from a place called Amiternum. His full name's Gaius Sallustius Crispus. I kind of wish we called him Crispus rather than Sallust.
Yeah, so why'd we go for Sallust? Oh, who knows?
Yeah, we could probably have a whole episode on what goes on with Roman names. Because sometimes we seem to go for the last name, the third name, what we call the cognomen, Gaius Julius Caesar. And sometimes we go for the second name, the nomen, as in Sallustius Sallust. It's kind of convention and tradition, I suppose.
And, we've abbreviated it.
Yeah, well, quite often we miss off the US in the anglicised version, I suppose you'd say.
Sure. We do that down here in Australia as well. If we put an O at the end.
I think you'd probably be Sallow.
Sallow,
really
you would. So tell me about young Sallow.
Okay. Well, he was born, we think, around 86 BCE, kind of born into a time of turmoil. His whole life, Rome is in turmoil because this is the point where Sulla and Marius have had their civil wars and Sulla has become dictator. And so we've already had civil war in Rome. We've already had conflict between Romans. This is sort of the normalized world that he's born into, although, as we'll see, he hankers for a past that he claims was better.
So he's a romantic.
Yeah, I guess that could be one word for him for sure. We know he must have come from an elite family because he has the normal political career of a well-born Roman man. So he goes into the Roman magistracies at pretty much the earliest age he can. So he's got the political career where he gets to be quaestor at a fairly early age. That's one of the steps up the tree. And he enters the Senate. And this means that potentially, although the chances get smaller and smaller the further you go up, but he might have been looking one day at being consul. He doesn't ever get to be consul. He kind of has a failed political career, if anything. He would be thinking that he's doing well by about 52 BCE when he gets the very important role of Tribune of the Plebs. This is a role where you're meant to represent the vast majority of Roman citizens who are plebs, as opposed to patricians. And being their tribune, there's more than one each year, means that you represent them in the Senate and also in the various assemblies. You have the veto of any law, of anything. It's a really powerful role one that by the 50s BCE, important politicians like Julius Caesar need to have a tribune of the plebs or two on side. All right, they need to have somebody who can, if not actually wielding that power of veto, at least be able to threaten it. Otherwise, you're powerless. And it's a very tumultuous time to be involved in Roman politics. It's not surprising that Sallust is a victim of all of this.
Mm. You say that he's a failed politician. That failure comes up pretty quickly, doesn't it? He gets too close to the wrong person.
Yeah, he's already picking sides, as almost everyone in Roman politics is at this point. And the much bigger question most people put down to those who are still backing the Senate very strongly and the power of the elites in the Senate and those who want to represent themselves as being for the people. So Julius Caesar's very much on the side of deriving his power from the people. He's very popular with the Roman populace. And Sallust has kind of chained himself to Caesar. I mentioned the murder of Clodius, the tribune. Sallust takes the side of Clodius against Milo, his murderer, and Cicero, who's kind of on that same senatorial side. He's deciding to be on that side, and at that point, it's not the winning side. At this point, he is seen as one of Caesar's allies, and Caesar is the person helping out his career. He's not rising up the ranks any further at that point, but Caesar helps him by giving him a praetorship, by putting him in charge of a particular region of Rome.
Mm.
And by this point, we're into the 40s, and Caesar is involved in a civil war against Pompey from 49. So Sallust being an ally of Caesar means he's actually involved in that civil war. He's involved in taking care of a province in North Africa during that civil war. And he's made the governor of Africa Nova towards the end of the civil war. Pompey's already dead by that point. This is always a dangerous thing to do, to be in charge of a province, because it's not uncommon to be charged with extortion when you return. This happens to lots of people, to the extent that people like Cicero actually brag about not having extorted the people of Asia when he was governor there. It's like companies who say, we'll turn up on time, like it's a plus. It was unusual for the Romans, and the details are not entirely clear to us, but when Sallust returned to Rome, he was charged with kind of with immorality. It's a weird thing to think of somebody being charged with. It wasn't extortion at such, some kind of malpractice. Therefore, he's up before the Senate on trial. Caesar helps him out again, and because of his intervention, he's not charged with anything. He's not fined or exiled, but his political career is over.
Okay. Judging by the tone, I gather, I mean, we can't know for sure, but it's likely that those are trumped up charges just to get rid of him?
Possibly. I think that most people who have been in charge of a province, something can be found against them.
Mm.
It's probably just the case of, do you have the right enemies in the right place for them to do it? And are they powerful enough to do it? All right, so they might not be completely trumped up, but other governors might well have got away with it if it weren't for the fact that this is a point where Rome is really polarized. You could almost see it as a bit of a proxy war where they can't get at Caesar, but they can get at one of Caesar's right-hand men.
Yeah, so it gives Caesar one less man in the Senate if they manage to get rid of this guy.
Yeah.
And even though Caesar intervenes and gets rid of most of the charges, just the fact that they've got rid of him means that they're happy with the outcome.
This clearly colours Sallust's view of political life in Rome, though.
It would.
Yeah. People are feeling quite depressed about it anyway, given that there's been so much violence, civil war, Romans killing Romans, people really torn apart by this. But Sallust feels that he personally has suffered more than others. So he moves into his writing career at this point in the late 40s, probably after the murder of Caesar in 44 is when he starts this at all. So his works seem to be published in the late 40s.
Mm.
And he sort of talks about that as a way of doing work for Rome because he can't be a politician anymore. And he kind of tries to hype it up as something better and more long-lasting. But I think that anyone who reads between the lines sees a very disgruntled politician who feels that he's been stymied by enemies.
Yeah.
So in the first of his works, The Conspiracy of Catiline, he basically gives you a little rundown of his life and says why he's ended up doing this as opposed to being still heavily involved in Roman politics. He says at about chapter 4. My earliest inclinations led me, like many other young men, to throw myself wholeheartedly into politics. Now he's going to tell us why he's so bitter about it. There I found many things against me. Self-restraint, integrity, and virtue were disregarded. Unscrupulous conduct, bribery, and profiteering were rife. The second part of that could be a summary of what he was accused of when he came back from Africa. And although being a stranger to the vices that I saw practiced on every hand, he's so innocent, I looked on them with scorn. I was led astray by ambition, and with a young man's weakness could not tear myself away. However, he says, I ended up exposed to odium and slander. And then he goes into why he's writing history. After suffering manifold perils and hardships, peace of mind at last returned to me. I decided I must bid farewell to politics for good. But I had no intention of wasting my precious leisure in idleness and sloth, or of devoting my time to agriculture or hunting, tasks fit only for slaves. He's not bitter at all. I had formerly been interested in history, and some work which I'd began in that field had been interrupted by my misguided political ambitions. I therefore took this up again and decided to write accounts of some episodes in Roman history that seemed particularly worthy of record. Task for which I felt myself the better qualified, inasmuch as I was unprejudiced by the hopes and fears of the party man. Right, I'm not involved in politics anymore, so you can trust me.
So is that a dig at Cicero there?
Well, look, that whole question is really hard to explain, because if you look at it on paper, Sallust being an ally of Caesar, but Cicero doesn't come out of this as the bad guy.
Yeah.
Catiline is very definitely a criminal in this, and Cicero saves Rome. However, he's also not the one given the most prominence because Caesar and Cato are the ones who get to make the really prominent speeches. So his attitude towards Cicero is complicated in this text. However, I imagine that if he did feel bitter about Cicero, the fact that Cicero has now been murdered might actually temper that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah,
it hasn't ended well for Cicero either.
So this is the first work that he published after leaving politics. Can you nutshell the Catilinian conspiracy for me so we know what we're dealing with? Why did he think that this was a good event to write about for his first publication?
It's an event that happened about 25 years earlier. So it's something that is during Sallust's lifetime. He knew about it. It's actually a big question why Sallust picked the particular subjects he did. And some historians feel that he bigs up these topics more than they deserve. And in a way, the conspiracy is only very, very famous because he and Cicero wrote works about it. So it happened in the 60s BCE, comes to a head when Cicero's consul in 63. And Catiline is this rather disgraced aristocrat, very, very high-born family. He's tried on a couple of occasions to become consul and failed, notably in 63 when Cicero became consul. And so he decides that the way he's going to deal with this is by leading an uprising to take over the Roman state. He's got various aristocrats on his side. Also, according to Cicero, some of the urban slaves, which is a dig at Catiline because involving slaves is a bad thing. Some women who are generally described as fairly despicable, and also a Gallic tribe. So this is potentially a conspiracy against the state, which is put down by Cicero. Catiline is killed during the fight that ensues. And the big problem with the conspiracy afterwards, at least from Cicero's point of view, there are other leaders left over. They're Roman citizens, should they be put to death. And that's really what the work of Sallust is leading to. It ends with this debate as to whether the Roman citizens should be executed. This is not tradition. There is a law suggesting exile instead. Should they be executed? Cicero decides they should. But that will actually dog Cicero, and he ends up briefly in exile. So it's something that has repercussions afterwards, I guess. And Sallust would argue that it's a signal of the divisions that are occurring in Roman society at that time, which will lead to the next civil war.
Despite being a sexy topic, if I could call it that, why did Sallust write about this? He had an agenda to push in it, didn't he?
Yeah, and again, there are different points of view on this. You could read it and say, look, Sallust on the face of it is he's the enemy of Cicero. He's obviously anti-Cicero. He took Caesar's side in the murder of Clodius. He's obviously Caesar's man, and Cicero ends up on the other side of that civil war. He doesn't make Cicero out to be the bad guy here. Okay, Catiline is definitely a danger to Rome. But I suppose he does something quite clever in that while he has Cicero's speeches as one of his main sources and also the records that he can get from the Senate, he allows Cicero to be someone in the right, but he kind of diverts your attention more towards Caesar and also to Cato, who are polarized about whether the execution should happen. And right at the end of the work, that's the focus of the work, because Cato and Caesar gets this enormously long speech. Now, some people have thought in the past that the point of the work is a kind of defense of Caesar, because Caesar argues they shouldn't be executed. And this has the potential to make Caesar look like he was sympathetic to the conspiracy, even maybe part of the conspiracy. But I think most ancient historians these days think that's a bit of a simplistic way to look at Sallust, that he's not just writing this to defend Caesar. It's much more about this is a microcosm of what can go wrong in Roman society at this point, because there are so many divisions. He wants to go back to the olden days. Even though he's a follower of Caesar, Sallust comes over as somebody very, very conservative. So he talks about how life was much better in the olden days, how things have really fallen apart there. And you can tell that even from that quote that I read out, where he's saying, you know, there's immorality and injustice in politics. And if you are actually a worthy person, then basically you'll have the carpet taken from under you like I did. So he's quite despondent about the political scene in Rome. So even though the Catilinian conspiracy, the work, is about these events that happened from about 65 to 63 BCE, so over a few years, Sallust starts the work by talking almost like philosophically. The very first line, every man who wishes to rise superior to the lower animals should strive his hardest to avoid living all his days in silent obscurity like the beasts of the field. He then goes into Rome used to be great. We used to value goodness in people, and now we don't anymore, and that's why we're in this terrible mire of civil war and division. And in fact, he's talking more generally than Rome. Accordingly, the world's first rulers, who were called kings, he says, in those days men had not yet learnt to be covetous. Each was content with what he had. So he's kind of harking back to an imaginary golden age where nobody envied and nobody stole and there was no greed. And then he puts it down to a particular historical point, basically just before the Persian Wars in Greece. He's blaming contact with the East for this covetousness. Suddenly we became aware of all this luxury from the East. It's a kind of a well-worn Roman trope, this idea that we suddenly had the chance to get, you know, gold and statues and money and spices. And so we just became lazy and indolent and greedy and didn't fight anymore. And we weren't tough anymore. So he's sort of buying into that idea of decline, of Roman decline and general world decline as soon as we come into contact with this stuff. So then he goes on a little later to say, success in agriculture, seafaring or building always depends on human excellence. But many are the men who, slaves of gluttony and sloth, have gone through life ignorant and uncivilized. So that's where we are now, and that's where we get to this point where, as he says, unscrupulous conduct undid my career.
Yeah.
So he's kind of putting himself into this worldwide decline of luxury and indolence taking over and using that to explain the crisis in Republican Rome. He's taking these really big concepts and saying they explain what's going on.
It sounds a bit like he's using the opportunity of writing a book to tell Rome what's wrong and why they shouldn't go by these mistakes that he's going to talk about. Here you go. There's something you can learn from this. At some stage, I'm going to get to the conspiracy.
Yeah, he does shortly after that, to be fair.
Yeah.
He says, I'm going to give a brief account of the conspiracy of Catiline, a criminal enterprise, which he thinks is memorable as it is unprecedented and fraught with dangers to Rome. So it is this idea that we can learn from this danger. So you need to wake up and get back to the old ways is sort of the implication there.
So as a historical work, how does it stack up?
Well, not everyone regards it highly. As far as we can tell, and we have Cicero to compare against, and of course Cicero was a major character in this event, he doesn't seem to follow the chronology in quite the same way. So he kind of stretches out some time and makes some things appear to happen closer together than they actually did.
Yep.
So as a work, it's not always considered entirely reliable. But he would have had access to records in the Senate. And at the time, there were histories of Cicero. Cicero wrote about his own consulship himself. Mm. So records that we don't have anymore were available to Sallust. And of course, he was alive during that time and could talk to other people who were part of the Senate during the conspiracy. Generally, it's considered to be a really well-written work. If you don't necessarily buy all of it as historically accurate, it's still rhetorically important. If you're going to read it, you can study the way it's written as an example of great writing. So the speeches at the end, for example, of Caesar and Cato are really great rhetorical works.
All right, so his second work that he published is The War Against Jugurtha. Nutshell, what was that about?
Okay, so this is actually earlier in Roman history, and Sallust wasn't alive during this time.
But likewise, it sounds like he goes, oh, this will be a popular topic that'll shift a few copies.
Yeah, so this is written slightly later, and it's about events from around 110 BCE. And basically, it's a provincial war. It's a war against Jugurtha, who is a leader in Numidia. Sallust says that he chooses it because it was great, bloody, and of shifting fortunes. So in other words, dramatically interesting, all right? There's a bit of tension. Would the Romans win? They know the outcome, but still, he can make it dramatically interesting. And this is interesting because it represented the first challenge to the arrogance of the nobility.
Ah.
So that's in chapter 5 of the Jugurthine War. The Jugurthine War is a slightly longer work, but it's still, as we should mention for all of Sallust's work, they are monographs. It's one topic. It's fairly short.
Mm.
It's not a great sprawling history. So what he's saying is we can see here in the way this war was conducted that the nobility are not just going to be accepted as the leaders. All right, there is a danger to Rome, and we're going to need somebody to be in charge of this who is not necessarily from one of the older families. Because the man who ends up being in charge of the Roman army is Marius. And Marius is a new man. He doesn't come from a family that has had consuls.
Mm.
All right? He's risen up the ranks because he's a military genius. So for Sallust, he can say this is about social change, having Marius become powerful through this war. So that's sort of the rationale for why you write about this war.
What was Sallust working from to write this book then?
Well, works that we would really love to have, particularly Marius's kind of second in command is Sulla, who he will end up having a war against, of course, a civil war later on. But at this point, they are very much working hand in hand. And other Romans involved in it, Scaurus and Rufus, they all wrote memoirs.
Okay.
So he would have had their personal accounts of this. We don't have those memoirs anymore, which is a real shame. We'd love to have Sulla's in particular. He also tells us at chapter 17 that he has North African sources, Punic sources, which he gets translated, which is really interesting because this is a case where somebody's actually using sources in another language and from the side of the enemy, I suppose.
Yeah, that he's actually bothered to go and find those sources.
He's doing his research. He's not just going and finding, you know, the acts in the Senate and writing them out in a more florid form. It has been described as novelistic, so, you know, as opposed to history, which implies, oh, it's not very accurate, which may be true. But I think Sallust in some ways suffers from the fact that he does know how to write a really good narrative, an exciting narrative, which doesn't mean that it's necessarily inaccurate.
Mm.
It just means that he knows how to attract an audience, because Sallust was really popular almost instantly and continued to be and was particularly popular during the Renaissance. People wanted to read Sallust. He was considered exciting work to read at the time.
Mm.
But, you know, he doesn't give us a lot of detail on exactly when things happen, which I guess we like to have that now. We want to know exact chronologies. He can be a bit vague on that.
Yeah, okay. And you've got other historians, especially analysts, who are very particular and regimented about telling you down to the day when things happened.
The analysts, as their name suggests, they're going year by year, and that means they tend to stick to a chronology. So we do have a much firmer idea of when we can fix certain events. Sallust is not writing that. He knows that tradition. He could have done it. He chooses not to for these two works.
Did he have an agenda by writing about this one? Does it have any similar kind of themes that he's pushing as the Catiline conspiracy?
Absolutely. In all of the works, he seems to talk about moral decline being the cause. So he's got the same kind of agenda where it's about greed. So there are commanders who are easily bribed, and that's a problem. And Jugurtha can bribe them at times. He's surprised if he can't bribe them.
Mm.
You see it in other Roman authors too, but perhaps particularly strikingly in Sallust. He's really interested in character and character flaws and how they connect to the bigger picture of history, how they're kind of letting the side down, letting Rome down. And at the same time, he's really telling us what would make a good Roman. So Marius and another character, Memmius, come out of this really well. They're both reasonably successful, but and they're also kind of unbribable.
So the third work that he's known of, but we really don't have a lot of beyond fragments, do we, is a Histories.
Yeah, called the Historiae, which makes it sound like it should cover a much longer period, but in fact, it takes a fairly concentrated period. It's a period between the Jugurthine War and the Catalinian Conspiracy, 78 to about 67 BCE, so about 12 years. The reason that he picks this might be there was an already existing history by a man called Sisenna, who ended his work in 78 because that's when Sulla dies. So he's picking up at that point. Unfortunately, we really don't have enough of this work to really comment on it very much. It's so fragmentary what we have left. Some speeches, four speeches and a couple of letters. And that's because those bits have been quoted by others.
Mm.
So it's not because we have literal fragments. It's just the bits of Sallust that have been quoted are what we've got. These, as other works of Sallust, clearly were highly regarded in terms of their style and writing. And that's why they get quoted, because they get used basically as school texts.
Yeah.
This is how to write something rhetorically powerful. I mean, it's a kind of testament to Sallust that even with the work we've lost, we have bits of it kept because of their intrinsic value stylistically.
So is there anything that happened in that 12-year period that would tie in with the slight agenda pushing that Sallust did?
Yeah, of course, because I guess he sees the whole of the late 2nd and 1st centuries BC as Rome in decline.
Mm.
Who's fit for office and who's not? I mean, this is a time when Pompey is rising to power, so he may well have commented on whether Pompey was going to be a good leader or not. He's the one who's going to come into conflict with Caesar, so we can imagine that there may have been some pointing out of Pompey's flaws. Pompey's also heavily involved with, although didn't get most of the credit for, the war against Spartacus, the slave war, which Crassus kind of got all the credit for. So we would have seen models of leadership there and a very dramatic account, perhaps, of another threat to Rome.
So you've alluded that he was very popular during his time.
There are conflicting responses to Sallust. So Tacitus was a big fan, which is, I think, a great compliment because, of course,
I was about to say, if Tacitus likes your work, then you're doing something well.
Yeah, Tacitus is such a great stylist in terms of his writing. And the main work we have on rhetoric by Quintilian, writing in the late 1st century CE, not that far from Tacitus, says that he is kind of the Roman equivalent of Thucydides.
So that sounds like the sort of thing that, you know, Sallust would put on the front of his new book as an endorsement. You know?
Well, he could have done it if he'd still been alive.
The Roman Thucydides.
Yeah, he would have liked that because he clearly is really influenced by Thucydides' style and approach. Quintilian says that Sallust is a greater historian than Livy, which I'm sure some would quibble with.
I
mean, it's a very different kind of history.
Fighting words.
Much to that monograph form. It's a bit like comparing apples and oranges, I think. So we see kind of written all over it the influence of Thucydides, although modern historians, I think, would not put Sallust on the same level. They wouldn't regard him as kind of grappling with the ideas of having the great intellect that Thucydides seems to show. So that's a comparison that is made in antiquity that modern historians might not agree with. Marshall, similar time frame, perhaps 150 years after Sallust dies, wrote one of his epigrams celebrating Sallust. He says, according to the judgment of the learned, he will rank as the prince of Roman historiographers.
Ooh.
And he's being translated into other languages way into the second century in the time of Hadrian. He gets translated into Greek by a scholar called Zenobius. So he's not gone away centuries later. He's still regarded as really significant.
Yeah.
But we do have an account from Suetonius's On the Grammarians, which is much, much more critical. You know, it's a quote that's full of very pointed nastiness. He says that a freedman of Pompey called Linnaeus was so devoted to Pompey that because the historian Sallust wrote that Pompey had an honest face but a shameless character, tore Sallust to pieces and wrote a biting satire, calling him a debauchee, a gormandizer, a spendthrift, and a tippler, a man whose life and writings were monstrous and who was besides an ignorant pilferer of the language of the ancients and of Cato in particular. So a bit of a plagiarizer, apparently.
Mm.
This is pretty nasty stuff, but I think it's quite fitting for Sallust because Sallust is criticizing that kind of behavior in his works, all right? This idea of being excessive, luxuriant, slothful.
Mm.
And then Linnaeus is using exactly the same kind of language of Sallust. It would really have been hurtful.
An appraisal with an agenda there.
Yeah, and look, what Linnaeus was apparently getting at is that Sallust does try to sound deliberately archaic.
Mm.
It's this idea that you could criticize him for not writing in the most up-to-date language and style and forms, but he has actually done that deliberately, and it sort of fits in with his agenda of it was better back then, all right, to use this language. But he is very, very good at it. You know, it's not a mistake. It's not because he doesn't know how to form style and sentences that would sound very contemporary. It's because it fits with his message. So he does it very deliberately, and he does it because he admires that older style.
Mm. How does he stack up as a historian then? Because he's a very different historian from Livy and Tacitus and other analysts that you'd come across. He seems to be quite unique in that way.
Partly it's because we've lost a lot of works. So we have lost other works that concentrated on particular events. So there was a tradition of writing about a particular war, a particular event. What it means is he can sort of be much tighter than somebody like Livy, who's writing about centuries and centuries and centuries, or Tacitus, who needs to cover, you know, all of the Julio-Claudians in one work. It's a more limited kind of history because it is about that event. He tries to stretch it out to have meaning in terms of what's going on in Rome, what's going wrong with the world in particular. Still, at some point, it's kind of shallow in its remit because it's about a four-year period in the case of Catiline. It doesn't have that breadth, that development that we can see in something like Tacitus's Annals.
Mm. And it'll also ignore other events that happened in that time.
That one disaster, as he sees it, that is unfolding at Rome. It is novelistic in that way. It's kind of got tunnel vision, moving towards this inevitable end where Catiline dies, for example, and Rome is left with this dilemma of what to do with the conspirators.
Mm.
But he does try to use that as a kind of paradigm for what's happening in Rome. So I think that Sallust is still important because he's a good and exciting read. And he tells us something about one possible mindset in the late Republic, one way of reading Rome's recent past. And also, he's interested in writing about the recent past, which not every historian wants to do. They want to stretch right back to Aeneas and Romulus and go through all of Rome's history. He's much more contemporary in his focus. He's much more interested in addressing the concerns that we have now, or at least he has now.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. You can come and like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us both on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we start counting down to our episode C with something a little special.
Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.